You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Reggie Carpenter. Reggie, it's good to have you here.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Eric.
So the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation about what you aspire to live, how you aspire to live, what you've done, who you are? What do we need to know?
Well, the first question is the big question,
yep.
Isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Who am I?
Yeah.
Long silence.
We're 58 about minutes. 10, 15 seconds on the radio. If it gets over that, then the FCC gets concerned.
Well, I don't really know how to answer that because it's kind of a comparative question. Who am I compared to other people? Or who am I?
Compared to who you were?
To where I was.
Or who are you compared to the environment around you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or just who are you? Who do you aspire to be?
Here's who I know I am today.
Yeah.
Today, I know I'm a storyteller, and I was always a storyteller ever since I was a little girl. Love to make up stories, always love to tell stories, and I feel that I'm just so grateful because stories have been my teacher my whole life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't discover stories until I was well into my 30s. I'd always loved to read when I was a kid, and I'd loved to write, but I sort of stumbled into a professional storytelling performance by David Novak, a storyteller from, where is he from? He is from Asheville, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sat there gobsmacked and drooling. My eyes were rolled in the back of my head. And I went home and told my future ex-husband all the stories. And I just said at the end of it, that would really be something to do with your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I started and I was abysmal. But, you know, failure leads to success. And
it can. And success rarely starts without a failure.
Yeah, well, I've had plenty of those.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to learn. And it was really when I failed miserably mm-hmm. that I went, oh, there's something more to this than I'm understanding. And up to that point, I've been telling mostly traditional folk and fairy tales
mm-hmm.
from around the world.
Sure.
This was in the mid-90s, and then I began to get interested in my family's stories, my family
mm-hmm.
genealogy, and found that I had so much treasure at my fingertips because I grew up in a small town in northern New York on the St. Lawrence River in the Thousand Islands. I grew up in the same town, Clayton, that my dad grew up in, and my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, all the way back, you know, to the early 1800s.
And some of those grandmothers, too, I assume, no? Or
well,
were they all imports?
Yeah, it was the fathers that
were
all
constant.
From there.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was, you know, to have that kind of history and that kind of longevity and that kind of familiarity with a place,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
An eternal sense from the St. Lawrence River. So that began to build my personal repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I just started looking for those stories.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, I wrote a book about that. Yeah, that's been my progression.
Sure, sure,
yeah.
Sure. And there's a dance between being the story and being the storyteller.
Yeah,
it's
always.
It's a fascinating way to live life reflectively.
Mm-hmm.
So let's cut to music. You brought some music with you, and I understand you want to open with Journey.
Yes,
and do you want to
love
say something about that before we play it or after?
Oh gosh, no, go ahead and play it.
Okie doke, here we go.
Thanks.
Took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy himself to trust. He took the midnight train going anywhere. A singer in a smoky room, a smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the night. It goes on and on and on and on. Strangers waiting up and down the boulevard, their shadows searching in the night.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Reggie Carpenter. So, Reggie, tell me a bit about that song. Why did you pick it?
Well, I love the song. I love the title. But the story behind that song is, for me, is about, oh gosh, in 2011, oh, my life had just really hit the skids. Everything had gone wrong. Everything possibly had gone wrong. And I had to sell my home. And, I was on the way to the closing of my home, which mm-hmm. I didn't want to sell, but I really had to. I heard this little voice whisper in my ear saying, turn on the radio. And so I turned the radio on, and this song was playing with Don't Stop Believing came on. And I went, okay, all right. I won't.
Right, right.
And I went into the closing and I went, all right, whatever's going to come is going to come.
Right, right, right.
So, but since then, life has been an upward journey for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool, yeah. Cool. And actually, between the introduction and this response right now, the question I like to go to next is, to live the life you value now, what did you have to learn? What did you have to go through? What were some of the things you had to go through in order to know how to live the life you value now? The coincidence of hearing that song and kind of the
long
breath of
it. Pause.
Long, yes, 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 yes.
Ah, gosh. If acceptance were the answer to all my problems today, what do I have to accept? And I would accept that everything that I've gone through, I've needed to go through, and I'm grateful to have gone through.
Right.
So
how did you come? My guess is that you didn't just arrive at acceptance. You kind of grudgingly accepted some things, or some things you just had to accept.
I failed.
You failed at acceptance. We all fail at acceptance. Yeah. So, what did your path to acceptance look like?
Well,
And I let me just project here a little bit. So what's really important about this show is what's personal but not truly private. And what's personal is what's affected our life and that has affected others in our lives. And it's not private because that effect has been so widespread and so visible. Mm-hmm. That once we can talk about it with some perspective, we can learn from it and others can see our learning and can take it to heart themselves in a way that we often don't talk about. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Well, in some ways, I think the greatest thing I always had to accept was that I'm a bit of an oddball, and that this idea of being a storyteller and then becoming a national storyteller and then traveling around the world and telling stories is an extremely romantic idea, but it never struck me that way. It just struck me as something supremely practical because that's what I've always felt I was born to be.
You do what you know how to do. You become what you were born to be.
So that to me was never, I've never understood why people look at me and go, a what? You're a what?
Right.
So now instead of saying a storyteller, I say I'm a spoken word artist because that has some cachet, you know. And it's true. Mm-hmm. It's just funny. I think that what I've also accepted is that everything that's ever happened to me, and I've had a number of pretty dark things happen, that allowed me to become a holder of stories because it gave me a foundation of compassion and empathy for other people's mm-hmm. experience. Right. And to also find that, you know, it's easy to feel very precious, especially when you've had some hard times. But the fact is that really my life isn't precious. I've never experienced anything that someone else hasn't.
Right.
And what I've been able to understand is that within every story, and particularly every personal story, are universal themes. And those universal themes always go down into, you know, love, abandonment, betrayal, trust, faith, mm-hmm. forgiveness, redemption.
Violence.
The themes of life that are prevalent in every culture and have existed since the beginning of time.
Yep.
So even though I may tell you a story about third grade on the St. Lawrence River with Mrs. Carter, your understanding what it was like for you to be a child and to have that special teacher.
Right. And one of my teachers, just if you do not know the story that you are living, you have not engaged your life.
Mm.
You know, so it's not one story, but it's many, many stories. But the point was to put them together in some narrative form so that we could hold on to those things. When you tell your story, like you said, the more specific it is to you, the more specific my response is going to
exactly.
be.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's yeah. very powerful.
Yeah, it is.
When did you... So, what got in the way of your seeing yourself as a storyteller? Was there something that got in the way? I'm projecting here. You said you didn't realize it until you went to this event, and then all of a sudden it opened up. But it had been part of your life all along.
I didn't know that was a job. You know, I really didn't know. I came from Clayton, you know?
Right.
Nobody was that. Really, that day just lightning struck. And I just really, it wasn't some grand master plan.
No, no, no.
I just went, wow, that would really be cool.
What had you been trying to do that didn't fit before that?
Oh, God, every job I had, I failed at. I was miserable at it. Waitressing, horrible. I was like, oh, get it yourself.
A little sassy on that side, yeah. Too.
Yeah. And just, I was an aerobics teacher, and I was pretty good at that. Yeah, I was just sort of a fly-by-nighter, mm-hmm. to be honest.
You didn't have a place to land.
No, and I didn't really have the capacity to land, you know.
So what gave you the capacity to be grounded and to tell stories?
I don't know. I just heard it.
How did you discover it?
Yeah. I just fell in love.
Right.
That is really what happened.
So you fell in love, and then you failed at love.
Mm. Oh, miserably.
And so what happened? How did that play itself out?
So I was doing a gig at a school, and this was early on when I just learned. I thought, oh, all I have to, when I think about it, it's so ridiculous. All I have to do is learn 5 stories. I'll only have to know 5 stories my whole life.
Yes.
You know? So I went, and I was so miserably horrible. Oh, it was abysmal. The kids were looking at me like, what? What's going on? and the applause was like this. Yeah. And the principal came in and said, you don't really have to do your second show. Ouch.
Oh, wow.
And I went home. And of course, I was mortified and humiliated. But I went home and I went, there's got to be more to this than I think. And that, you know, I love to fail in
that sense.
Yeah.
There's got to be more than what I knew.
And so I went, I got to be thinking about this in the wrong way. And that's really when I went home and I started to study. And I got books out by Ruth Sawyer, The Art of the Storyteller. And I started to listen to the people that I had begun to really admire. Bill Harley and Diane Frelott and Donald Davis and David Novak and Judith Black and Jackie Torrance. And I started to just listen to the canon. Mm-hmm. And I read these books, and they all said, you know, it's good to put a song in your story. And I went, oh, okay, so I want to learn this story, and I could put a little song right here. Mm-hmm. And the beauty for me was that I was kind of living a, Rapunzel lifestyle at that point, because I really, there were no storytellers around me, so mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I didn't have anyone that I could look at and say, well, their style is definitive. So what I was able to do during that period of real study was able to develop my own style.
Right.
And when I first went out, and this was such a long time ago, this was when traditional stories were really reigning true. Now, in America, personal stories are more in vogue, but
now,
back then...
This was in the 90s.
Yeah, this was in the 90s. Yeah. So back then, when I went out, I was chastised and told that my style was too individualistic. And because a traditional teller was someone who was supposed to sit in a chair and deliver the story without accents or movement or dancing. And because there is some validity to this, because the less I insert myself into the story, then the more the story can come into the forefront. But that's not me.
Right. But, and,
So I just thought, well, I'm just going to have to do it my way, because I really don't know any other way to do it. And I just hung in there. Basically, you know, a big part of success is outliving everybody else.
Right. And just the fact that you lived is a success in itself.
True.
But I'm one of the seminary professors that I had, who was in his last years of teaching when I studied with him in the mid-1980s. So he was born in 1920. He would, for decades, come into classroom dressed, male, female, whatever, in the character that he was going to be showing this spiritual practices, the church history, the religious issues, the fights of the times, and he would deliver it from that person's point of view.
Oh, neat.
Every lecture was a different character and a mm-hmm. different, and he had to become that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was moving around, and he could sing or could recite poetry or whatever.
Cool. That
was just, yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's a long history in teaching, but we lost a lot of that in this culture for a long time. That's my perception.
I guess so.
I come from rural America in Northwest mm-hmm. Missouri, mm-hmm. and I listened to storytellers who were really just old men who told stories, mm-hmm. who were born in the 1870s and 1880s mm-hmm. and 1890s when I was a very little guy, and that's a lot of where my personal spiritual identity and comes from, because they were not the kind of macho persons that would have been mm-hmm. developed by the 20th century or mm-hmm. or whatever, and they held stories in a different kind of respect. And passing them on was a very important part of life, and developing your own was an important part of becoming a person, was having the stories to share.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what have you learned? How did you push through that reaction of you're too individualistic? You're too, how did you bear through that? And to where the people, where it seems like that criticism does not get made now, or am I mistaken from what you're saying? That was a criticism.
No, I hear it, but I don't hear it as a criticism anymore.
I see. Okay.
No, I still get, she has a very unusual style.
Right.
Which, well, I'll tell you a little story. So in 2009, 10 years ago, I was invited to tell stories at the International Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee. And many storytellers, there are other larger festivals mm-hmm. in the country, but, you know, many consider this to be the jewel in the crown. Yeah. And it was getting closer and closer to, it's always the first weekend in October, and it was getting closer and closer, and I thought, you know, I could go there and tell stories that I know people are going to just love, or I could just go and be me. And maybe they'll love it, maybe they won't.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to make it to the top of the heap, I've got to still be able to put my head down on the pillow.
Sure.
So I just went and I just decided, you know, I can only be myself. And that's what I'll be. And that really was the moment where I really can't worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
I could only be myself, whoever that might be.
Right. And how does that acceptance change the way you are in the world? Or, you know, how has that affected your practice to just openly accept that?
I don't really know. I mean,
did you fret before?
Not too much.
Not too much. So you really just kind of accepted the inevitable.
Yeah, I just kind of, I embraced it. I just,
yeah.
I know I am who I am, and the reason they've invited me is because I am who I am,
right,
not
right.
because I'm someone else.
You show up different. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's one of the standard translations of the name of God, and one of the exercises I have people in groups do is say I am who I am, and say it with different emotional intensities, like I am who I am, you know, I am who I am, I am who I am, you know, and so that they say it with all these different points of view
mm-hmm.
and can experience being someone very different,
mm.
and then in playing with it from, you know, 10, 20 different emotional and perspectives, they can begin to kind of find more comfortably who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a powerful statement. And you just, you know, I am who I am. Yep.
I am what I am.
Yep.
Comes
and there's
from
the Popeye.
Popeye.
And that one's from Popeye. But that was taken from the English translation of the Bible.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, for the great I am. Uh-huh. You know, it's a funny, it's a very funny play with kind of Jewish humor, uh-huh, and of that era, uh-huh, and coming into mainstream culture.
Oh, well, so, thanks for teaching me that. I didn't know that.
It's a nifty thing. Anyway, so I want to let's cut to music, yeah, and then we'll come back with some more questions.
Okay.
What do you want to play next?
Oh, let's play the Let the Weak Say I Am.
Let the weak say I am strong. Let the poor say I am great. Let the blind say I can see. It's what the Lord has done in me.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Reggie Carpenter. So Reggie, earlier in the show you talked about how you found a well of stories by going into your past, mm-hmm, and that past is rooted in Clayton, New York. And what did you discover about yourself that you didn't know or really appreciate when you began that dive?
Nice metaphor. What did I discover? Well, I think initially I discovered that I had a story.
Really?
I didn't know I really had one. You know, I was just thought, this is my life. And
you just told other people's stories.
Oh, yeah. Historic stories. I mean, I just told folk and fairy tales. Yeah. And then And then when I got curious, the reason I got curious was because I was teaching for an arts and education program in Binghamton. And one of the things we talked about with the children was, do you know your birth story? Or do you know how you got your name? And I thought, you know, I kind of know my birth story, and I know why my name is my name, but I didn't really know. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, this sounds terrible, but I grew up with it, so I thought it was funny. When every birthday, I heard, "Happy birthday! You almost killed Mom, you know."
Well, that was said of my older brother.
Right?
Yes.
And so I always felt like, oh my gosh, I had done something terrible and I right. never meant to do it.
Right.
And so the story that I learned that I came to from a particular perspective changed over the course of learning and telling and creating the story. And
sure.
that's something that's happened to me every single time. Uh-huh. So when I was born, my mother, I was born dead. I was born wearing a caul, C-A-U-L. And a caul is a very thin sheath of skin that covers a baby's face. And it's believed to bring good fortune and that child can speak to spirits and... Hmm. And the caul itself has always been prized by midwives who give it to sailors who think if they carry a caul, a dried caul, mm-hmm. that they won't drown. So I was born dead, brought back to life, and during the night my mother hemorrhaged and she almost died. We were living in Pennsylvania then, and my dad was a salesman. So we didn't own a home, and he called everybody from home, but no one could come to help them. So he ended up putting my brothers and sisters into foster care, and I went into foster care too. And you know, none of the kids could come home until my mother was well enough to take care of us. But my mother was very weak, so I lived with a neighbor. So I interviewed all my brothers and sisters. About their experience. It was the first time I'd ever heard that. My brother Tim went to stay with an Amish couple that discovered he needed glasses. Hmm. My sister Cindy was 5, and she stayed with a Catholic family. We're Catholic. Catholic family who they on Fridays, this is when you had to still eat scrambled eggs or fish. And she saw they put ketchup on their scrambled eggs, so she did too, but then she threw up all over their table. And she met a little girl, used to meet her at the gate and give her root beer barrels. And she loves root beer barrels. My sister Mary was just 3, and she remembers being taken into a house, and a woman had made her hot cocoa. And it was in August, and the milk had skimmed on the top, and she didn't like that. And while the woman was showing her the bathroom, my father left. And my eldest brother said, you know, Dad didn't have to do that. But if you talk to my parents, they would say, you know, we called everyone, and no one could come and help us. And we would lose the apartment if I didn't work. And there was no one to take care of you kids, so I had to do it. And... so at that time, you know, my father could be faulted for not having said, I'm coming back. But I also think that what a horrendous thing for them to have to do.
Sure.
And so for a long time, that story to me was about being abandoned. And it took me a lot of time to grow up and see that they came back. You know, that it wasn't a story about being dropped off. It was a story about being picked up.
Right.
And what I've discovered over my pretty long career now is that each story really is about love and forgiveness. And that love and connection. And sometimes the stories end where there is no love and no connection. But the story is still about love and connection.
Right. And the aching mm-hmm. is the presence of its absence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, we call those sad stories. And then we have happy stories where it ends with a satisfying love and connection. But
on our terms.
So all stories are really about love and connection.
Yeah.
You know. So, yeah, every personal story that I've created has brought me to another place of opening up mm-hmm. and changing my perspective
right.
From going. So, you know, you were interested in knowing what did I discover from such a long lineage of carpenters, right? And in a small town like mine, you're never who you are. You only go who you come from. And carpenters, my father in particular, who was a pretty scrappy guy.
But a salesman.
Well, he was a salesman. He had been injured in the Second World War. He had severe PTSD. And I think being a salesman was, you know, something he could handle.
Right.
Being, going
Brief
from door to door.
Yeah.
But he's a family man. Anyway, my dad became a social worker, but he was injured in the Second World War, and during that time he had multiple operations that eventually landed him crippled when he was just 53.
Wow.
So he didn't have an easy time of that. He was in a lot of pain. But what my dad, so we were looked upon as, well, poor white trash might be a little extreme, but not too much.
Yeah, I mean,
and what
I grew up on that in that realm.
Yeah. So yeah. What I discovered was that I have a great family, and I wouldn't have traded it for $1 million. And that from the outside we might have looked one way, but you know what? We knew who we were,
mm-hmm.
and that my parents were really good people with abysmal judgment. And that just
and
wasn't
that is a statement of grace.
Yeah, it wasn't, there was no malice. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was just a lack of forethought.
Right.
And I think my parents were magnificent. Mm-hmm. I'm tremendously grateful for having grown up on the St. Lawrence River because I grew up around something eternal, you know, mm-hmm. that, and I grew up in a town where carpenters, we have a sense of place, but it wasn't just us. Everyone in our town, the last names never changed.
Right, right.
And there was a continuity that you wouldn't find other places. Along with that goes sort of a small town mentality, but small town mentalities exist every single place.
Well, but also it's five generations of my ancestors are buried within 6 miles of each other
mm-hmm.
in Northwest Missouri. When those old men would look at me, they knew my great, great, great grandparents.
Right.
And they could look at me and wonder what will become of this kid.
Mm-hmm.
In my own family, because of just the misfortune of a number of different things, we grew up in subsistence farming. We had a house with an outhouse until I was 8 years old. It was just, and there were 7 kids and 2 parents in a 2-bedroom house. It's tight. But we always knew where we were headed. We didn't necessarily knew who we were. And that's something that I've had to kind of, because they were launching, they were leaving that behind, but they were raised among people who had a notion of what the world was around them in this little small town, because in small towns, there's also people who've been out, they've seen things or they suspect things and they encourage people. And then there are people who are just, you know, you can't do that. This is the way we've always done it. It's just a narrow little thing. But in some ways, there's more diversity from my experience in small towns than when I've lived in big cities, New York or you know, other urban areas where people just have a lot of assumptions about what they can do, but no real root. And no real sense of what it means to be, what was the term you used for yourself that you had to accept that you were just different, but it was another word you used?
Oddball.
Oddball. And I'm an oddball. I grew up in a community of oddballs,
mm-hmm,
you know,
definitely.
And if you weren't an oddball, you didn't have standing.
You didn't fit in.
That's right. That's right. That's right. But it meant that you were a person to be wrestled with, a person to be taken seriously, in your own right. And that's what it means to be in the world and about the world. So I hear that very strongly in your stories, and they're from the Thousand Islands area.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn about, or what do you take from those stories that help you to understand? How did you come to terms with your parents? They were good-hearted people with really bad judgment.
Mm-hmm.
How did you turn that corner? Because a lot of people never turn that corner. But, you know, when you do turn that corner, things look a whole lot different.
I became a parent.
Yes.
Yeah, and suddenly I went, oh, this is really hard.
Yep.
And I made some really bad choices.
Right.
And wouldn't have intentionally harmed my children for $1 million, but I harmed them.
Right.
And, you know, there's no manual. And I'll say, too, that really when I look at, so my parents were caught up not just in a family story, but they were caught up in an American story. They were caught up in a generational story. They were caught up in a political story. You know, veterans, they don't just live their own lives.
Right.
I mean, there are so many layers. And, you know, I just... I'm telling you, if anyone who's listening, if you could just take a moment to really let go of the story, quote unquote, that you're telling yourself, and just ask, what else might there be? What else is true? You know, what else is true? Okay, yeah, my mother abandoned me when I was 3. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't, but I'm just saying,
right,
maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is true. And you have your thoughts and judgments and feelings around that. But then you can ask yourself, well, what else is true? What else is true? Well, she sent me a birthday card once. And suddenly, that statement, those feelings of abandonment may change.
Right.
And they take you to a different place.
Right.
And suddenly, you know, the hurt, it doesn't excuse what's done. It doesn't change it. It doesn't. There are many, many things in my life where I just kind of go, wow, I just will never understand how that decision got made. But I'm still standing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not a weak little flower that will bend in the wind.
Or break.
Yeah. And, it's the stories that have changed me. The stories have changed me.
And they've changed you to appreciate your strength and to forgive the broken stuff? Or
I don't know.
Or what have they changed? What have
Well, they've just changed my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that I don't have to be so dang precious about everything. Oh, it was a big, oh,
right.
This, you know,
right.
Oh, boo-hoo.
Right, but as you told that story about the hypothetical person who was abandoned by their mother at age 3, you tell it with acceptance of the abandonment and acceptance of the letter and acceptance of the tie, the longing of the child and the longing of the mother that would have existed whether any of them acknowledged it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the story acknowledges it.
Yeah.
And in a certain sense blesses it and lets it have its own life.
Well, I haven't thought about that way, but I could see your point.
All I'm saying is that it gives it a reality rather than constantly pushing back against what didn't happen or what should have happened.
Your story isn't just yours.
Right. 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 And so one of the things about being an oddball is that we get to define ourselves, but everybody else gets to define us.
Mm-hmm.
We have our own story, but everybody else has our story about our story.
That's one of the things I really enjoyed about being in Ithaca for so long. I came here in 1976 when I went to Ithaca College School of Music, and I was in the pool at Ithaca Fitness, or Cayuga Medical, you know, and this guy that I went to college with came in, and I looked at him, and, you know, he's older, and I'm older, and I went, oh my gosh, we're each other's scrapbooks, you know, because yep. I remember him when he was young.
Yep, yep.
And I'm going to visit, I'm going up to Clayton this Sunday to visit my cousin Wendy and Shirley and Harold and Tori and Tracy and everybody. And I was like, yeah, I remember when they were young and they remember when I was born. And that is so cool.
Yep. Yep.
And the other thing I love about going home is, and it's funny to me that I always call it home. I think of Clayton as my home.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I live here. I've lived here in Ithaca the majority of my life, but Clayton is my home.
Sure.
And when I go there and I'm with the carpenters, we all have very distinctive kind of carpenter features, you know, this long, thin face, and we got our accent. And when everybody's sitting around, we all sound
it
alike.
Comes on
and I'm
pretty
like,
strong.
I'm like, oh, there's my people. I'm with my people.
Right.
And I'm very grateful to have a sense of place. Many people don't.
Right, right.
They don't have a sense of home. Yep. And I have a sense of home.
Yep. We both came to Ithaca in 1976. I came to Cornell on a full scholarship.
Oh, what did you study?
Anthropology, biology, and ethics. I was an oddball. beginning of life issues, sexuality, beginning of life issues, end of life care issues, decision making, and all those different realms, stuff really close and personal. Very intellectual, and I'm a very visceral person, and it took me years to kind of come to terms with that. But my people, I'm from King City. I'll always be from King City. But all of the houses and almost all of the people that ever knew me there are gone, because that part of the United States has basically evacuated of people because there are no jobs. Mm-hmm. There is no economic future for the most part. And I don't think I have any, I know I have no first cousins in the immediate area and maybe some second and third ones, but you know, that's where I came from. And my people were for 150 years.
So, that's an American story too,
yeah,
isn't
that's
it?
That's just a different variation. But I too have been in Ithaca most of the time since 1976. So
and we could have done worse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yeah, that's true. That's true. Where I want to come to now in the show is, what do you do to take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, and how do you know you need to do it? I mean, this care is your spiritual care, basically. And physical, emotional, and intellectual.
Well, I tell stories. And that keeps me running tip-top.
Yep.
Yeah, I get weird when I don't tell stories. Or weirder. And
Because what you say becomes more precious? Because you're kind of putting things, cramming more into one thing? Or why do you become weirder?
Oh, I hope I never become more precious. But
when you don't have an outlet to do what you do, sometimes things get a little too concentrated.
Well, so, I can't remember where. I was at the International Storytelling Festival, and Bill Harley and I were there. And I just love Bill Harley. And he says, you know, we're like thoroughbreds. We're bred for one thing, and that's the race. And when they don't get to race, they get squirrely.
Yep.
And that's what I am. I'm a storytelling thoroughbred. And when I don't get to do it, something's just off.
Yep.
Something's off. And it's not just about me getting praise and all of this, but it's the stories and being with people and having community and the beauty and magic of stories. I just love them. And they set me right.
Mm-hmm.
So I do that. But I recently got a dog, Josie. Mm-hmm. She's a golden. I got her from the Golden Retriever Rescue. There's another word at the end of that, but I can't remember. Anyway, Janet Gray is the woman's name, if you want a golden retriever. She's the woman. And, oh, it's wonderful. Anyway, Josie is a great dog, But as the trainer told me yesterday, she learns really quickly and forgets just as quickly. So I made a commitment to this dog that she was going to be a great dog. She's got a few little kinks in her.
Right.
And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to make a huge commitment to this dog, and I'm going to train her, and I'm going to spend a lot of time with her, and we're going to hike, and I'm going to teach her how to be around people, and basically she's teaching me how to teach her.
Right.
And that's really what's happening. Yep. And so I do that. I belong to First Baptist Church, which I really like. I just became a member because I'm very grateful to go there. Because I didn't have to take a Christianity test. And I still don't know exactly where I stand on Christianity, but I figured that church is probably a good place to find it out. And but also they do a lot of social good, and that's really what I wanted. I wanted to be more socially involved, to do good in the world. I just bought a home in Common Land that I love, so I have a lot of peace. I garden a lot. I hike. I'm learning to play the ukulele, which is totally joyful.
Yes.
And, I have friends.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Basically.
Yeah.
My kids.
Yeah. And so I was listening in there. There's a lot of different kinds of physical stuff you do, and one of the things... storytelling is a physical sport. I mean, that's mm-hmm. something that a lot of people don't realize. You kind of, you're all in, your whole body mm-hmm. is doing mm-hmm. it. But so is the gardening and the walking the dog and the staying in touch with friends and stuff like that. And that also, the piece that gets to though is another set of emotions. You know, how do you, In the stories, you get to follow the arc of an emotional or other kind of connection out as you weave it out. How do you bring the emotions of your others into your life for that kind of reflection or consider? How do you bring things in that you haven't? How do you learn is more what I'm. How do you take in what you see around you as this is a silly question, or at least it's an ill-formed question. when you are...
I might be able to help you.
Yes, go ahead.
The greatest skill a storyteller needs is to be a good listener.
Yes.
So that's what I do.
Yes. And the reason I asked that question, in what settings... do you find it easiest for people to speak and for you to listen, or do you, or is it just, are you just like listening 24/7 or, you know, whatever else? How do you?
Well, people talk without speaking.
Well, yes. Yes.
So
they talk with their bodies.
The world is talking.
Yes.
I don't really know how to answer that question. I listen for silence a lot.
Yeah. What transpires in silence is often truer and clearer than what is vocalized.
I don't know. I'm just me. I'm just another slob on the bus. I'm not sure I'm listening to what's true. I'm just listening.
Well, no, but for me, it's just, it connects. And when I have that connection, that to me is a truth. It's not, I'm not talking about some infinite, you know, or I'm just mm-hmm. talking about there's this quality of direct engagement
mm-hmm.
that I can know and trust and we don't have to overanalyze it.
I don't really know how to make these general statements around things, because I have a very subjective viewpoint, but I also I don't know. I only have my viewpoint. You know, I can't really be sure about how it translates to other people. and wouldn't presume to know so.
Right. And I don't make the general statement to presume it would be that way for other people, mm-hmm. but rather to say that life for me is a process of becoming more disciplined in my subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And also more disciplined in objectivity, mm-hmm. realizing that because I use words and because I communicate to others, I'm never completely subjective. Those words have right. definitions and things. We never, ever get to the point of total subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And we never get to the point of total objectivity. But in this vast space of experience from different points of view, we begin to notice and experience and value and treasure and engage. And that's the reason. So
yeah. Cool.
But you're right to name it the way you did just then. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Where is your storytelling taking you next?
Oh, well, I can tell you my schedule.
But also the direction of your life. However that works.
I can exist on both levels. I'm really thrilled because I'm going to Gray Fox Bluegrass Music Festival next week and performing there. That'll be first for that. But at the end of this month and for the last 6 years, no, for the last, yes, 6 years, I have gone to DePauville, which is a very small town outside of Clayton. DePauville is the little town where I went to first grade. And the library there, I'm the storyteller in residence. And I've been the storyteller in residence there for 6 years. And Karen Lego is the most wonderful librarian ever. And the library used to be a two-room schoolhouse. And that's where I went to first grade with Miss Streets. And so I love going and being the storyteller in Clayton. So I do lots of children's programs, and then I also do an adult program. And I've just written a brand new show, three new stories, one old one, a couple of new songs, called It's All Going to the Dogs. And it's about my life as in the arts, and what I've had to do in order to stay in the arts and pay my mortgage and all that sort of stuff. And just the good fortune, the craziness of my life has just been, I don't have enough imagination to even think up my life that's so good.
You couldn't invent it.
Oh my gosh, it's just so good. And so I'm doing that, and then I got a bunch of festivals in September. I'm doing, and then I'm going back to the International Storytelling Festival in October, and then I have a bunch of schoolwork and just lovely. And I teach up at Ithaca College. I teach storytelling, which always... Oh, such a great experience being with these young people and helping them see that they have a story. Mm-hmm. And storytelling is a skill, and as a skill, it can be learned. Yep. And, there's a rubric and a criteria for excellence, and we build community, and it's just phenomenal. But the places where I'm really wanting to grow... In 2005, my brother Tim was killed in a car accident, and during that time, after that time, my stories really took on a different meaning. I began to see how stories could help people through grief, particularly children, and I began exploring the use of storytelling around grieving. So I have been fortunate to be hired by hospitals and go in and work with spiritual care and... just, life care people, arts and education, arts and medicine. Mm-hmm. I'm really just a baby. I've been doing it since 2009, but I'm really just learning how to do it. And again, failure has been a huge part of my success.
Cool.
So that's really...
That's where your heart... Those are the places where your heart is moving.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm very fortunate.
Reggie, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thanks, Eric. You too.
And we're going to close with a Dave Davies song.
Oh, love this song. Downstream where the river meets the sea. Love me some Dave Davies.
Well, this river has always been my friend. And I don't know what lies around the bend, but in the end, I know right where I'll be. Downstream where the river meets the sea. By and by, when the river takes me round where I'll lay my burdens down, all the friends I've been missing will be waiting there for me. Downstream where the river meets the sea. The sea.